Hey, y'all, and welcome to the last episode of the Early Team Show. In this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Vishak Vaisvanathan. Vishak was one of the first engineering hires at PostScript. He is a coding bootcamp graduate with a background in mechanical engineering and has worked at early stage SaaS startups since 2015. Vishak is currently a staff engineer at PostScript, where he leads product strategy and architecture, drives solution and tech partnerships, and helps hire and onboard high-performing engineering teams. In this conversation, we talk about the benefits and challenges associated with going the coding bootcamp route, the importance of tailoring communication so that it resonates and is easy to digest by non-technical colleagues, especially leadership, and the impact of triaging customer support tickets and radically prioritizing them can have on your progression at an early stage startup. This was a wonderful conversation, and I hope that you enjoy. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Rob Conversations with Contributors at Early Stage Startups. Immersed in ambiguity and navigating the unknowns, we talk about how they figured it out or didn't. I'm your host, Shaheen Mosadegzad, and this is the Early Team.
This episode is brought to you by the Split Pay app, a seamless way to split a group bill. I personally use Split when going out with friends to pay for the items I ordered instead of splitting the check down the middle. It's easy to use. I simply take a photo of the bill, and then I'm able to allocate the items that I ordered, and then knowing how much I owe or someone owes me. It's easy to use. You simply snap, split, save. Check it out and download the app today at splitpayments.app. Vishak, welcome to the Early Team. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thank you, man. I'm excited to be here.
For folks that aren't familiar with you and your background, why don't we start out high level? If you can share a little bit about yourself, where you went to school, where you're from, what do you like doing, and where you are today?
Sure. Yeah, maybe I'll start where I am today. I'm currently at a e-commerce marketing SaaS company called PostScript. We send texts. Okay. And my journey here has been interesting. I'm a software engineer here. And I actually didn't study software engineering. I studied mechanical engineering when I was in college, and I'm a product of a coding boot camp. So yeah, right. did a career shift a couple of years after college and found my way into the tech world. You know, it was in 2015. It was the hot thing to do, and it's worked out pretty well. So I've worked at a couple of startups now. Love working at startups and being able to have an impact and see that impact. And that's kind of the high level.
Okay. Very cool. Why don't we start out with the mechanical engineering front? Can you talk a little bit about how you got into the field? Is that something you initially gone to school to go that specific route, or is it something that came about from exploring certain things in school? What was the story there and how you landed on that direction?
Yeah, totally. You know, when I entered college, I had no idea what I actually wanted to do. I think a lot of people enter college just kind of taking guesses at it. So I went to UC San Diego, great school, enjoyed my time there. And when I applied and when I got in for the first quarter or two, I was a biz econ major and decided at some point early in my first year that I wanted to switch into engineering. And I actually had my dad's a mechanical engineer who also did a transition to IT in his career. And Indian family, like a lot of my mentors and like my uncles with the family were like, why don't you study engineering? Like, you've got a good, you know, you're good at math. Like, you know, get into engineering, like get into building stuff. And also just the group of friends that I happen to have, like a lot of them were taking engineering classes. So I switched into chemical engineering at some point. I was a structural engineer heading into year two. and then had a chance to get into the mechanical engineering program, which was, the department was mechanical and aerospace engineering, and they were the coolest engineers on the block at UCSD. And so applied and got into that program. And so like by halfway through my sophomore year of college, I had switched my major to mechanical engineering and really enjoyed it. Enjoyed the like the coursework. There's a lot of like intro to physics type courses and then a lot of applied math. And
then
we get into like, finite element analysis and like all your undergraduate sort of classes and the lab classes, like everything. It was fascinating. I really enjoyed it and graduated and ended up my first job out of college in San Diego was working for as a contractor for the Department of Defense, which was my first landing spot. Not an uncommon pathway for folks who study mechanical or aerospace at UCSD, because San Diego is, maybe a lot of folks don't know this, but San Diego is a big military town. And so there's a lot of defense contracting out there.
Very cool. Before we get into the contracting world, that which sounds interesting. What was it specifically about mechanical engineering over chemical engineering or other realms of engineering that you decided to go the route outside of that the cool kids were doing?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that could have been it.
Totally. Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of a joke. I think it's for me, it's been the idea that mechanical engineering is something I can see and I can understand. Like we're taking classes on like dynamics, right? Like what happens when a ball that weighs twice as much as another ball slams into it at 40 miles an hour. Well, you can like see that and feel it and interact with it in a really tangible way and intuit a lot of stuff. So you're sort of proving to yourself stuff that, at least early on, you're proving to yourself a lot of stuff that seems intuitive that you interact with in the physical world. I like dabbled in taking some of the chemical engineering courses. Like I took organic chemistry, struggled through OChem, tough class, you know, struggled through. I took an electrical engineering track course on linear circuits at some point early, and they have a different class for electrical engineers versus mechanical engineers. And so I took the EE one because I think I couldn't, you know, public school, I couldn't get into the mechanical engineering one. The class had filled up and I was too late to be able to get into the door. And I remember like day six in that class, I was like, this is just a different level. Like these people have a different baseline of knowledge on how electricity works than I do.
Yeah.
And their brains are just like better tuned to understand this stuff. I don't know what happens inside a wire.
They're wired differently.
I can't touch that. You're not allowed to touch the inside of the wire. That's pretty bad for you. So I like actually ended up dropping that course and just taking linear circuits the next quarter with the other mechanical engineers, which was like linear circuits for the layman. That was a much better experience for me.
I bet. And you're bringing up organic chem and I'm going to have nightmares tonight. I already know that. I was just going through two semesters of that was more than anyone should ever go through.
Yeah. Man.
Okay. Well, very cool. And so as you're graduating and you're getting to do contracting work for the Department of Defense, For those who are curious, what is that like getting finding a role and then working with the US government in that area and working in what I presume is a large sector and highly bureaucratic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my entry to it was just applying to as many, you know, after college, applying to as many jobs as I could.
Yeah.
And is a company that did defense contracting indirectly for SPAWAR, which is Space and Naval Warfare Research, which is a facility out in San Diego. It's a pretty familiar building on Highway 5. It's got this jagged roof line, kind of a landmark of San Diego. And I worked for this company, or I applied to the company, and you know, I was a mechanical engineering grad from UCSD and did well in the interview and started working there. And it was interesting because, you know, as part of the interview process, they were like, hey, you're going to need top secret clearance for this, which is actually the entry level clearance that you need, a security clearance that you need.
Yeah.
It's not the top level. It's misnamed. But they, you know, like doing, like they asked me some of that. I actually didn't end up staying at the job long enough to actually go, to actually have them take me through that process. But yeah, like every day I would badge in to a military facility and, you know, work on kind of interesting engineering problems, but not what I thought they were going to be. Like I wasn't out there doing actual structural analysis or like figuring out how things moved. I worked on like a much more process driven thing of electronic equipment and like maybe calculating the center of mass of something, you know, like nothing too complicated. But it was good. It introduced me to some parts of work that I really liked, which were a lot around like organizational and process type things. And I realized like, I like the hard, you know, dive deep parts of the work, but a lot of the stuff that I enjoyed in that job was, hey, like we're doing this process this way, and then we print out papers at the end of the week, and then we like share them with each other. Like, what if we just digitize part of this? Or like, what if we get all this stuff in a spreadsheet and like standardize how we do this? And that's interestingly, I think, what eventually indirectly led me to software engineering in a weird way.
Yeah. Interesting. And as you're explaining this, what I'm hearing is you went into mechanical engineering for the physical aspects of it. And this experience is now then pushing you more into software side of things and not as physical.
Yeah.
At what point did the idea start brewing in your head of, okay, this is actually the stuff I really enjoy. Mm-hmm. And should I consider making a shift in career? And did you also think about like maybe staying in that area, but going more the software route?
That's a great question. I think it dawned on me at some point, and this must have been, I think, 2014, that if I wanted to do the cool stuff, right, in mechanical engineering, then I probably was going to have to think about a master's degree. And, you know, 2014, interesting time for the economy, and like maybe not the worst, but you know, kind of interesting. And software was really booming, and I had some friends who I graduated with who had moved back to the Bay Area. They were starting tech jobs. They were loving it, and that's when it kind of I started thinking about like, hey, like that seems like a pretty good place to be, versus going back to school and getting another, you know, 100 to 200K in debt to be able to do the stuff I really love here. And so I think that was kind of the realization. And I ended up leaving that job and moving back to the Bay Area with like nothing lined up, with just the idea of like, I'm going to get a job back up in the Bay Area and hopefully it'll work out.
Yeah. And did the concept of, instead of going and getting my master's and going further into that versus I'm going to go to a boot camp, which is less time and potentially less expensive, did that ease the decision for you? Or was it still a daunting challenge for you to figure out, okay, what do I actually want to do overall?
Oh man, do I have a story for you? This is a fun one, actually. How did I land on going to a coding boot camp? So, you know, I moved back to the Bay Area. I was still applying for jobs. Like there was some point where I was like, I just need a job. I studied Mechie. Let me try to get a job here. And you know, a lot of the stuff that I wanted to do, I was just underqualified for. Like I didn't have enough experience to do.
Yeah.
And you know, I had mentioned family earlier. Like my dad actually works in he was working for a company and happened to make a connection through work for someone who, like for this guy who was a CEO of a small digital supply chain tech startup, right? And he was like, hey, I met this guy. You should just give him a call. Just give him a call. He may have some career advice for you. And this guy's name was Scott Slinker. And he's someone who I think is like, I think I can single-handedly credit him with paving the path for me to get into tech. And I, wow. you know, I gave him a phone call, and I was, you know, I'm 22, maybe. You don't really know what to say. I'm 22. I'm green. I'm inexperienced. I don't really know what to say. But we start chatting, and he gets real direct, and he's like, listen, you seem like a bright kid. You should go to a coding boot camp. Google App Academy. This is a coding boot camp that I'm familiar with. And he says, you know, it's going to be kind of hard to get into. You're going to have to study, but if you get through this boot camp, give me a ring after and we can talk. And that was it. Okay. I you know, did the Googling, found the program, submitted an application like same day, if not, you know, maybe the next day.
Yeah.
And that was it. That set everything into motion for me.
What was it like going through a coding one, going through a coding boot camp, but also going from mechanical engineering to then software development and, as we call it, engineering in our world?
Yeah.
Did anything translate over well for you?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? That's a good question. I think yes, like high level answer. But the cool thing about going to a coding boot camp, and the thing that I realized from going to it, is I had classmates who were in my cohort. I had a classmate who was a forklift operator, you know, and I had classmates who were philosophy majors in college, like folks without any kind of technical background, but they were all just brilliant, bright people. Like, I think both of those, both of the two people I just mentioned were better than me. Like, they're better software developers than me, understood stuff even quicker than I did. But I do think a lot of the analytical, you know, a lot of the analytical thinking, like how you break down problems, translated, right, to some degree. And just, you know, like some of the, I don't know, being quick at math, being able to figure out, like I got to imagine, like, you learn about remainders at some point when you're doing long division, when you're in elementary school. But if you're not necessarily like studying something super technical, like, do you care? Like, I wouldn't. Like, if I was, you know, if I was in college and I was studying art, like, when's the last time I would have had to think about a remainder, you know, or like conceptualize that? And little concepts like that are important in software development. And because you're still a little bit closer to thinking about math, you know, you're like, I'm here. But still, the philosophy major guy who I went to the coding bootcamp with was probably the brightest guy in the class, and gave me an appreciation for how, like, you don't need to come from a specific background or have a ton of experience to excel at something.
Were there challenging aspects of going through the bootcamp where you may have potentially like questioned your decision, or was it just as the further you progress, you're like, no, this is, I'm on the right path here?
Man. Yeah, that's a great question. I will say, like, App Academy is one of those like fully immersive. It is not like part-time. It is, hey, you're gonna lose 12 weeks of your life. Like, say, you know, say see you later to your friends and family. And like basically every waking moment for the next 12 weeks for you, at least back then, this is how it was.
Yeah.
And I would imagine it's still the same. Every waking moment is going to be thinking about and learning how to write code and how to build software. And so, it was also a program where, like, at the end of every week, they would do an assessment. And if you didn't do well enough on the assessment, you could be out of the program. I mean, there's like,
oh my gosh,
that was part of, that's kind of how it works. It's every week.
Yeah.
Every week we grade you. And that's part of that is because their pricing model was based on job placement. So you didn't pay anything upfront. They would take a percentage of your first year's salary. And I don't know if that's even how they still do it, but back then that was a fairly common model for coding boot camps. And great, because it creates a ton of accessibility for folks who want to try this thing.
Right.
And also great because it creates the incentive for them to make a really good program that's focused on job placement afterwards.
Right.
But to get back to your original question, it was just 12 weeks where I thought about nothing else. Right. And I was with a cohort of, I think, 55 or 60 people who were on the same boat as me.
Yeah.
And that, like, that level of immersion is, it just like, and having your peers around you kind of on the same boat as you, I mean, it's a boot camp. Like, that's what it is, right? So there weren't a lot of times where I thought during the boot camp, like, do I really want to do this? Because the eyes were just on the prize. Make it through the next week, make it through the next 12 weeks. And then you reach the promised land.
Yeah. Now that, obviously it's been a few years, but looking back at your bootcamp experience, for someone that's potentially thinking about it, what are the pros and cons of considering going to a bootcamp and making a career pivot for someone that's thinking about computer science?
Totally. Do you think, like, versus going to like a program, like a college program, or versus self-teaching?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say going to a coding bootcamp has made me a big fan of secondary education, like, what do you call it? Alternative education pathways.
Right.
Because, and especially, you know, the time in the market then, like web development, software development was hiring a ton of junior folks, and we just needed butts in seats. Right. Yeah. So, like, the timing was good, but I learned more in those 12 weeks than I had learned in multiple years at college. I think there's still something to be said for going to college and living the experience. Yeah. And also, like, you know, in 12 weeks, do you really change your worldview? Probably not. But, you know, going through 4 years of college and learning about engineering kind of makes you look at a lot of the things in your life and have an appreciation for how they're built. You know, I have a friend who likes to joke and hold up random objects to me and say, "Is this engineering?" And I'll be like, "Well, yeah, kind of." is a wine glass engineering? Like, yeah, someone had to think about how to shape that wine glass and how to make it, the equipment that made it. But huge fan of alternative education. I think, you know, the program that I went to was really competitive, and as I mentioned, like, probably pretty cutthroat in some ways, or, you know, like, they expected a lot of us, but that worked for me. That was something that I was able to buy into and enjoy. And it drove me to, like, compete with my peers even. And I love that. I kind of grew up in that sort of environment, like, schooling environment when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I'd say, like, yeah, like, if you've got a goal in mind, why not stop the world for 12 weeks and make it happen for yourself if you can do that.
Yeah.
But yeah. And it also, I think, makes you a very different type of software engineer than folks who may have done like a longer program, especially in those first couple of years. And we can talk about that a bit more, but I think you're shaped a little different. You don't maybe know as much fundamentally, but when it comes to problem solving and, like, being pragmatic, they're, like, kind of, you know, you're kind of, you kind of think differently. And some companies find that really useful.
Well, let's delve into that one. The experience of 12 weeks, right? So 12 weeks in the grand scheme of things isn't a very long time. Mm-hmm. How did you, as you finish the bootcamp, how did you find that first role? Did you call up this guy up and say, "Hey, I'm done. Now I'm looking for a job"? Or did you find somewhere else? And coming in, like, what was that like?
Oh, man. Yeah, we didn't finish the story. So the day I finished that boot camp, basically, you know, I gave Scott a ring again.
Yeah.
And I said, "Hey, I'm
Scott," right?
Scott. Yeah. I gave him a ring again. And I said, "Hey, I finished this thing." And at that point, you know, I'd stayed in touch with him throughout and just calling every now and then. And he's a, you know, he's like a good guy. And he would check in, which, looking back, like, I appreciate just so much. And he actually came to, like, our graduation showcase where folks showcase their projects. One, to support me, and two, because he was, you know, he's hiring. So he's like, let's see who else is in the boot camp. I applied at a bunch of other roles. You know, Scott matched the offer, and he also hired another one of my fellow boot camp grads. So me and my friend Nick both joined at Paradata, a digital supply chain SaaS company. pretty shortly after, a couple of weeks after.
That's awesome. Was your friend the philosopher that joined, or was that something else?
No, I think Google scooped him up. He did well for himself.
Wow. Yeah. Very Google of him.
Yeah.
Fantastic. When you joined, how big was Paradata? What was your role specifically coming mm-hmm. in? And talk to us about those first 30 days mm-hmm. of now being a software engineer.
Yeah. I mean, I joined. I joined as a, entry level software engineer. So did. So did my colleague Nick from the bootcamp. And what an exciting first 3 months. It was the company was 25 people, I want to say. It's hard to entirely remember. This was back in 2015. But I want to say 25 or 30 people then, and was developing this product and had paying customers already. And we were just writing front end and back end code for this web app and sponging as much information as we could. I remember 2 months in, my manager and I were having a one-on-one, and he was like, "Man, you're doing good. You've gotten a lot faster." And I was like, "What do you mean I've gotten a lot faster?" And he was like, "First 2 weeks, you were pretty slow. I wasn't really sure what you were doing, but things are looking pretty good now. You're crushing it. Keep going." And I was like, "Oh boy." And I just fixated on those 2 weeks. And I was like, "I can never be slow again. No one can ever think I'm slow again, But it was, it was an exciting time. It's full of imposter syndrome and God, I don't really know. Yeah. I don't really know anything about what's going on here, which you eventually come to learn is pretty normal. When you join a new company, you're not just supposed to join and immediately know how everything works. But yes, it was exciting and sometimes stressful time. I was working a ton, and by 6 months there, I felt I'm contributing here, and I had other coworkers who really helped me get there and coached me up and taught me a bunch.
Yeah.
So it was a good start.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so your drive was one of the factors of, hey, I don't want it to be those first 2 weeks. You made progress, et cetera. You'd mentioned there, a little bit of shortcomings of going to a boot camp early on, being able to look at challenges or knowing what you need to know. Mm-hmm. What areas did you have to level up to be able to continue that momentum of your progression?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a good question. I'd say when you go to a boot camp, we spend maybe 2 weeks. We spent maybe 2 weeks back then focusing on core computer science fundamentals, what is garbage collection from memory? How does that work? Or different search algorithms, that kind of thing. The truth that I found, and I find time and time again in my career, is that for the vast majority of software engineering jobs, you don't have to worry about that stuff. A lot of it is abstracted out for you, but having an understanding of it helps you avoid costly mistakes. And especially, I think when you work at larger companies where you're more focused on eking out performance from things, it's pretty important to understand those fundamentals. But at a startup that is, not serving millions of customers or millions of requests or whatever a day, you're really focused on developing things quickly and trying to find product market fit, experimenting and failing over and over again. And so you're a little less concerned about that, about those core fundamentals. And you're a little more just let's ship product, right? And let's get stuff out there. But there are other things there's a lot of setting up and learning, getting your computer set up and learning package management. I've got to read through logs to figure out why my computer is behaving differently from your computer when we're trying to run the same code. And that stuff you learn through experience. And I think when you go through a traditional, 4-year college program, you've probably seen a lot of that stuff and dealt with it a bit more before. And so sometimes I think back to those first 2 weeks and feeling like a fish out of water at times. And I attribute some of that to the fact that, you know, I went through a 12-week program that was largely on rails, where there was always someone like an instructor who was there to help me get through some of the minutia of getting started. But then after you get set up, you're in a pretty good position to be scrappy and like just focus on problem solving. And
love it. Okay. And what's fascinating about your time at Teradata is you started out in engineering, but you had a small shift in a different department. Can you talk about how your role changed over time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I moved at Teradata from being an engineer to eventually kind of being a lead engineer. And then eventually into like whatever the job of the month needed to be to some degree. So at a certain point we didn't have enough people in product, and I had gotten to know the product pretty well at that point from having built a lot of it. And so I stepped into like a product management role where I was doing, you know, I was still doing coding on the side, but like my main job was figure out what we're going to build and think about like how long it's going to take to build stuff, how we should sequence things. And it was interesting. I think a lot of engineers who go into product bring that knowledge with them and are able to apply it to make different product decisions than PMs without hands-on engineering experience might make. Not always better. And I've learned a lot about product management since then from working with incredible PMs I got the exposure from doing that. And then I also did some sales engineering, like solutions architecting type stuff, where I was on the road co-selling with SAP to large enterprise customers. Yeah. So got the experience of like flying out to Houston and trying to sell like a giant, like multi-million dollar deal to a huge enterprise company and try to be like the little remora, like our product being 1% of the cost, like tag on to a larger deal, and a lot of the dynamics that go in there, and a lot of the, like how do you, you know, you are the remora, you're not the big dog in the room, but your product might be kind of important functionality to closing this deal. And it was just good exposure to what sales looks like hands-on. And I met some really incredible salespeople and got a ton of appreciation for just like how good, great salespeople are at their jobs.
Yeah, exactly. And where for you, where did software engineering and sales overlap? Areas where you could use your skills as a engineer to then support you in sales, and then areas you're like, no, this is completely different and I have to just like relearn all of this.
Yeah. Fortunately, I didn't actually do sales. It was more like solutions architecting, right? So I was the nerd in the room who knew how our part of the product worked. And I could speak to like how valuable that is and how, you know, and how much of a difference maker that could be to your business and speak to their problems. Yeah. But it's much more problem and solution focused than it is about sales. So I can confidently say, I know nothing about sales. I would never make a good salesperson. That is like, those people are incredible at what they do. I'm, you know, maybe a jack of several trades. That's not one of them, you know, but I got to see what it looks like firsthand. And I think a lot of engineers can eventually move into solutions architect, say, you know, the solutions architect role. And that was a pretty natural one for me. And also having done a lot of the product decision making before that, I was also able to speak to some of that and then bring it back and then do more product decision making and then oftentimes go and implement the exact thing that I was pitching to build based on maybe trying to close a big deal. It's very customer driven development, like customer driven product development. But
is you're wearing these various hats, whether solution engineering or product or anything else that came up that month, were there things or elements that you missed from just building and shipping yourself that drew you back into that role? Or at times, where did you contemplate, hey, maybe I should, you know, go further into product and go into that craft versus continuing to code myself and be an IC?
Yeah, I think throughout all of my forays into other domains,
yeah,
I couldn't stop writing code. I just loved it. Like I just loved this. The immediate gratification of working on a project for, you know, a couple of hours or a couple of days, and then being able to ship that thing and see it live. And I just like writing code. It's satisfying. It's meditative a lot of the time. Nowadays, I hardly do it as much as I wish I could. But I knew that was a big part of, I could never let it go. And so I knew when I left, when it was time to look for a new job after I left PostScript, I was like, I just kind of want to start writing code. And there was also an aspect of like, as much as there was imposter syndrome, like being a software engineer, there was even more doing product and doing like, and being in the sales cycle, like, you know, a face of the sales cycle. And yeah, it's like, I think software engineering was always like, I can come back to my comfort zone and do something that I'm that I enjoy. But I think throughout all of it, one of the things that I realized was so important in every one of these roles, and that I was able to kind of like take from role to role, was just like this problem solving mindset. Like, how do you take any problem, break it down into pieces, whether you're trying to do that in a teaching sort of way to try to sell someone on why a solution makes sense for them, or you're doing it to try to figure out a product roadmap based on a strategy, or you're doing it to try to break down a feature and like, what are the pieces of code I need to ship? I'm just like, I'm the worst abuser of bullet points that you will ever meet in your life. Every single thing I've ever written is a bullet point, and it's hierarchical and structured.
Yeah.
And I think that's both because of and why I often ended up doing a bunch of roles. So just, hey, come in and figure this out in one way or another.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And being wearing different hats, whether it's solution engineering, sales, or product, how did those experiences then shape your approach to engineering, specifically in how you communicated, given that you had seen the lens of how those folks communicate, whether externally or internally, versus if you're in a day-to-day engineer and you're just communicating, let's say, with a PM or a designer on a daily basis?
Yeah. I think this like takes me back to a story when I was working at Paradata, when the CEO at the time, Scott, he's in the room with us. We're explaining to him the technical solution for something. And he just goes, hey guys, like, this is great, but I'm going to pause you. Pull it up a level. Like, what do I need to know? Right. Which is very like QB question behind the question. Like, you know, you're talking to the CEO, and that experience and all those other experiences working in different functions, I think you develop a sort of professional empathy for like what this person needs to do their job well and to succeed. And it allows you to tailor all of your communication to that, right? And be like, okay, my product manager doesn't like, I think my product manager's foremost priority is not like how I'm building modular reusable code. His foremost priority is like, are things that relate to the features that he's managing. And it's the top line of that. And this like salespeople's and like our, and you know, CSMs, like go to market user facing teams are even at a higher level than that, which is like, what can I sell? And like, how does it work? And you know, tell me at that level. And that was pretty formative and pretty important for me now still. And in the years after in my career was knowing how to tailor your communication for the audience. And then like, oftentimes like give people the amount of detail they need and give them the opportunity to opt in if they want more, but otherwise like don't flood them.
Yeah.
If you can summarize your idea
yeah.
and your ask and next steps in like three lines, then just do that. And that's great.
Yeah. I love that. And you were at Peridata for, when it comes to the startup world, for a pretty good amount of time. Mm-hmm. What eventually happened in terms of you thinking about a different role at a different company and wanting to transition elsewhere?
Yeah. You know, I wasn't even thinking about transitioning to a different role. I just started working like the Monday after I graduated from college, and then had been in like a 4-year sprint at Peridata. And in the middle, I had been entirely preoccupied with job searches and stressed. And so for the first time in my life, around like 2018, I was like, oh, I've got a little bit of money saved up. And I've never taken a gap year, and I've never really traveled the world in the way that I want to. And I'd already had the travel bug from a few international trips that I'd taken in the past years. And so in 2019, I started having conversations with my manager, like, hey, I'm going to take a year. Like I just want to travel. I just want to not work for a year, you know, and then sort of like, started planning for what that would look like and being able to leave the company in a good spot.
Yeah.
And sort of set that into motion. So in November of 2019, I left Peridata. I immediately flew out to Hawaii on a family trip, started traveling internationally for a bit, ended up in like 3 or 4 different countries over the next coming months. And then the pandemic hit when I was still traveling.
Yeah.
And that's when I had to come home and start thinking about, hey, you know, it's probably time to get back to work. Cause I like that year of travel that I wanted to do is not going to resume anytime soon. So then it became time to start looking for remote work.
Yeah. As you are taking this break and trying to get through what appears to be a burnout and rejuvenate yourself before going back, were there certain things that you did that were helpful along the way to help you recharge, including obviously the travel itself?
Yeah, I think you're saying like while I was still working, like what kind of, are you saying?
It more so after you left Peridata.
After I left Peridata, I mean, I didn't have my laptop with me. I like fully immersed myself in travel. I was just free roaming the world for a little while and wasn't really thinking about career next steps. Wasn't really thinking about what's next. I think it's important, and I've had other friends take sabbaticals. It's important an important part of what helped me recharge and what has helped some of my friends who I know recharge is that they're not anxious about what's next. They're not thinking about it. They're just like, let's be in the moment for the next couple of months and do the things that we love, and what comes next will come to us. And there will be a time for us to think about that. Yeah. And that's a very privileged position to be able to be in. And I want to acknowledge that, like to be able to like save up the money that you need and not necessarily like have people depending on you to like be continuously earning. And so I feel super lucky to have been able to do that. But for the four, 6 months that I was traveling, I wasn't thinking about it at all, you know? And I think that gave me a clean slate when I came back and gave me conviction in what I wanted to do next.
Yeah. And speaking of doing the next thing, where did PostScript enter the scene for you? Was it a conversation with someone about the company? Did they reach out to you? You found a job post and cold outreach. What was that like?
Yeah. So late spring, let's say of 2020, it was time to start applying to jobs again. In my head, I had long wanted to go work at like a FAANG company. You know, I was like, I don't really know what big tech is like. I think I feel ready. Right. So let's start prepping and getting the practice in to try to go for it. And along the way, I was also interviewing at like other companies to get some reps in, you know, also like if something really interesting came up, I was open to taking it. And PostScript just happened to be that something. I mean, it was a small company. I think it was around 15 people at the time I was interviewing.
Yeah.
The people that I met with made me feel incredibly comfortable. Like it was a rigorous but comfortable interview process where I was like, oh, I'm talking to human beings here, and we're working on this. We're working through this interview together. It's a conversation. They like were one of the few, maybe one of the only companies I've ever interviewed at that was like, hey, you're not going to know anything about us. So here's a PDF of everything you need to know about us, the size of the company, benefits, funding situation, like anything that you might need to know that you're probably not going to be able to find on Google. Yeah. Here's the pamphlet. And then we also don't need to waste time talking about this stuff during our 15, 20 minute phone screen that we're going to do. Like all this information is just here for you, which is an incredible job by recruiting, right? To just have the empathy to like know to just get after it. And it saves them time too. But also,
right.
But I loved that. And yeah, I just knew. Like at some point in the interview, I was like, this could be home for me for a while. I want to work.
Yeah.
I want to work with these people. I want to get on this rocket ship. Like, let's go.
Awesome. And when you joined, how big was your team specifically when you began working at PostScript?
Yeah, the company was, I want to say 25 odd people. The engineering team was five people.
Yeah.
And super lean. Everyone reported directly to the CEO, who's also acting as head of product and engineering at the time, which makes sense given the size of the company. And it was, and everyone more or less was full stack, like working on UX, working on back end stuff, just kind of doing it all, solving whatever the problem of the day was. So pretty like disorganized and swarmy, but in a good way that like you should be when you're at that size of company.
When you are reporting into a CEO who has many responsibilities, it's typically you kind of just need to like figure it out on your own and go about and pave your own path in a way and then keep them in the loop or et cetera. What was that experience like for you coming from Paradata? Was there an adjustment to need to be made or did it feel natural for you or any challenges along the way?
Yeah, I think a big part of the reason I joined PostScript was because of our CEO, Adam, who's still the CEO today. He, in the interview, just struck me as like an incredibly empathetic and smart person who had kind of had, who kind of had a vision for product market fit figured out, like knew, had conviction in what he wanted to build. And so when I joined PostScript, it wasn't the kind of 25 person startup that is experimenting broadly, right? Like what is our product? We knew what our product was. It was a big part of the reason I joined. We needed to deliver on what our customers needed and were telling us. And Adam was and continues to be like pretty involved in like product strategy type decisions, right? And just has like a, I don't know, just a great intuition for building products. And so it was good. I mean, he understands our product, like, and especially then, like through and through, and he had written a lot of the code that was already in place. And having a technical CEO is, I think in some places can be a curse, but in our case was and continues to be, I think, a blessing because there isn't a lot of swirl or flapping. It's just,
Yeah. In this specific role, what areas did you have to level up to match the pace or the skill set of the team around you to continue that momentum as well?
Yeah. I mean, e-commerce is such a different space than digital electronic
right.
supply chain for giant companies making, making smartwatches, right? It's a fast, hyper-competitive space with extremely discerning experts who are our customers. And especially now more than ever, but even back then, yeah, it's fast. And I think that's something that I had to learn early on was that, you know, I think a lot of shops talk about fail fast, right? And like, let's learn from our mistakes.
Yeah.
But that was true at a completely different level at PostScript, where I was like, this thing that you're shipping doesn't even need to scale. Let's just get it out there. And half the time, it's not even going to be something that we totally want in the form that it's in. We're gonna go back and tweak it. We're gonna have to make it better. Let's ship it to 10 customers and see how that works. And like it was velocity at a different level. It was also like it was radical prioritization at a different level, given our small team. So early on in my time at PostScript, I got put basically in charge of all of our support issue triaging because we didn't have a support team. So the CEO was doing this,
right.
And he and I would meet once a week or every other week and kind of go through the full list of issue reports that had come in that needed to get to engineering. And when I first started, you know, any bug that I saw, I hated. I was like, okay, I feel like we can fix this. Like, this feels easy. This is like a couple of lines of code and I think we can fix this. And oftentimes, because we were so small, I would be the one who was fixing them, which ended up being a great thing for my career. And but we can get into that later. Early on, though, working with our CEO on this, I flagged a problem with him and he was like, yeah, it doesn't work, but like, does it matter? And I was like, what do you mean doesn't matter? Our product isn't working as expected, right? And he's like, yeah, okay, but who's the customer who's experiencing this issue? And it ended up being a customer that was like on a free trial that wasn't even paying us yet. He's like, all right, cool. Then let's move on. Right. And just over and over again and getting into the habit as an engineer of being like, what's the business value? What is the dollars and cents amount of this pain that we're feeling and do we actually need to solve it? And now as an engineer at PostScript, you know, product engineering, it's like something I think about every single day, like every micro and macro decision that I make, you have to keep your eyes on the prize and think about like, how does this tie back to business value? And it gets harder and harder and more interesting and more meta, but it's exciting and probably the biggest shift in mindset that I had to make.
Yeah. One thing you're bringing up and doing the triaging of tickets, like having done similar, like we didn't have support, so we just set up support and everyone's going through tickets. One thing that does is also you become a lot more intimate with the product and how folks use it when sometimes they're using it the way you didn't even intend it for them to use it.
Totally.
But the second, the radical prioritization you're talking about, it's like, there's so many things you have to fix those days. It's just like, what can we live with?
Yeah.
At the moment?
Yeah.
Which I think is beautiful. Then let's talk about it. Your time triaging support tickets and that experience and how it shaped you.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what you said. Like I probably got to know the product at a breadth level better than anyone at the company for a couple of years thereafter. Not depth, like I for sure there's like folks who went really deep in the areas they did.
Yeah.
But that one like gave me like shifted my mindset dramatically in terms of how engineering connects to the business as a bigger picture and kind of like made me a entry level subject matter expert in a bunch of places. And now at PostScript I'm a staff engineer, mostly on the back end.
Yeah.
And I don't actually work on any specific team. Like I rotate from team to team. Sometimes I'm not working on a team and I'm just doing like week by week problem solving. And I think that role is like somewhat atypical. a lot of companies, pretty atypical at our companies, only myself and our founding engineer are not like dedicated to a single space or a single domain. Right. But it's yeah, like I mean, I'd like to think it's valuable and it's exciting right. for me. Like I love it. I love the context switching, and I think it's important to have folks who can kind of who do have the bigger picture in mind, even from engineering. Because then you can kind of help teams collaborate better. If there's a cross-functional feature or something that involves like three teams collaborating, well then yeah, I'd love to be in the room and like help stitch this all together, talk to the PMs, talk to the engineers, highlight challenges. And so the role that I have at PostScript right now is it all started with me taking on support triaging and just getting to know our product in a breadth way that a lot right. of a lot of engineers often don't get to do.
Yeah. And by doing that, is that, I don't want to say the sole reason you're able to connect the dots so well across the board at PostScript, mm-hmm. but how much impact has that had for you to be able to connect the dots going to different teams or working on different initiatives across the board?
Yeah. I mean, do you mean impact? Well, impact for me or impact for my role, like the company?
Both.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I love this stuff. I love being a firefighter or someone who is, who's kind of the flex player on a team who's there for a quarter and is just helping level up the right. engineers and also learning like a ton myself. And then I get to go to another team and be like, oh, like this other team is also working on something here. Maybe we should reach out to their engineers, reach out to their product manager
right.
and see if we could find some like shared building blocks that we can build upon.
Yeah.
And it's been an incredibly rewarding role for me. And one that I think it's a lot harder for newer hires at the company to break into, because when you've seen how the thing is built, right? Like, I may have familiarity with the feature in the past and like what it does. And now it looks dramatically different under the hood than it used to back then, but I still know why it's important.
Yeah.
And I still know like what our customers need from it. And I still know
right.
in my head how maybe I think it should be built. And so being able to have little slices of that knowledge in a bunch of places means that I can both context switch and be the person who's bringing folks together in a room and maybe driving a cross team initiative. So yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
This is like it's been serendipity for me, like being able to do this role at the company. It's also something that I would love to have more folks like in the same position to do. Organizationally, that's a challenge, because you're like, okay, well, engineering managers and teams in general like stable teams, and you obviously want people who are right. deep subject matter experts who just own like a whole domain. But then it's also good to like do tours on other teams and soak up some of that knowledge right. and be able to bring that back. And we're working on that.
That makes sense. And you know, we've talked about you've brought up all the benefits of being a flex player and how it motivates you and you love it and you enjoy it. I'm curious, as with everything, are there downsides to being a flex player for you and the challenges that may come with it?
Yeah. I think it's a dangerous thing to take for granted. And there have been times mm-hmm. in my career when oftentimes like I'm kind of a people pleaser. Like if someone needs help with something, I'm like, yes, I wanna hop in and help you understand this. And that can become dangerous for your work-life balance and your ability to prioritize the things that are the most important for the business. So that's, yeah, it's, there's definitely downsides. And I think if I'm running my own business, I definitely don't want someone like a tenured staff engineer to become a blocker or the only person with knowledge in certain areas. Yeah. And sometimes as an organization grows and changes, you can be left in positions where that's the case. Like there's probably a handful of things that we do that are super stable that like no one has had to look at for the last 2 years. And because I have, I may be one of a handful of people at the company that actually know how that things work, which is an organizational problem. But also I've learned largely, okay, if something is working for 4 years and you never had to look at it, that's valuable to the business. Like, yeah, don't rock the boat here. You did something right. Like, you know, you should enjoy that. So there have been times though, when I've just been stretched incredibly thin and I've learned, I think I've learned in my career to there are times when you want to hop in and help people and get hands on. There are other times when you have to say no and be like, hey, you're going to have to figure this one out on your own and you're going to be better for it too. Or just to let go and let people do things the way that they want to do them. Because it can be very tempting to be like, don't touch that. You're going to break it. But sometimes you just got to let it happen. Yeah. And folks, it's hot stove theory, right? You can tell someone not to touch a hot stove, but until they do it for themselves, you're never really going to know. And doing those in measured ways and like taking the right precautions is for sure. Like, I think a healthy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. Now that you've been at PostScript going on 4 years, are there things you're doing differently now versus the four-year sprint that you did at Paradata to help you prevent burnout or needing to take a longer break, et cetera, things like that that you're seeing pop up now?
Yeah, I think for one, PostScript has, I think I feel really connected to wherever I work and the business succeeding. Yeah. And PostScript has, like, the company has been, I would say, largely a success over the last 4 years. We're now at 270 odd people, and business is going well. And that's one aspect of it, is just knowing that what you're doing is it matters, and it's like helping the company be more successful, which was part of the burnout cycle that I experienced at my last stop. And I think the other piece that I've discovered about myself, especially over the last couple of years, is that I think, a startup is going to ask a ton of you, and it's tempting to just spend like the 12 hours a day and grind it out. And there are absolutely times and seasons of the year where I do that in short sprints, but I'm actually the most productive when I work fewer hours in a day. And like, I make sure I get my gym time in the morning and I take a walk in the middle of the day and I take care of myself. And I think that's been something new. Also getting into your 30s and having to think about your health a little bit more, but it's been good. I feel pretty fortunate to work at a place that has realistic expectations about what I can achieve and to have like empathetic leadership and also to have like excellent frameworks for how we think about radical prioritization, right? Like, no, we can't take on too much, but it also means that, I can spend time prioritizing my personal and my social life and making sure that it's firing on all cylinders, not just too much of one at a time. And it's interesting because I'll have days where I'll have 7 hours of Zoom meetings, but as long as I had a good morning, like took care of my health and I have plans in the evening, you go to bed satisfied and like ready to go for the next day. But there might be other days when it's not nearly as tough work-wise throughout the day, but because I didn't take care of the other parts of my life, you go to bed feeling kind of crummy. And it's really, for me personally, it's really kind of all or nothing. Like, I need to be able to do it all. I can't over-index on one, and I can't not do any of them. And I learned that about myself. It's created some sort of sustainability for me here. And I hope it continues,
Perfect. And I think staying on the theme of learning about yourself, let's bring it home with the last few questions. Looking back, not necessarily in the past couple of years, but looking back over your career, What are some things that, or one or two things that you've learned about yourself?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things I've alluded to it earlier in this interview is just people pleasing versus how would I put it? It's making people happy in the moment versus being valuable to other people, right? I think I got some really good advice a couple of years ago, or maybe a couple of years in at my time at Postscript, from a manager who actually wasn't my manager. I was gunning for a promotion and it wasn't happening as quickly as I wanted to. And I was burning myself out trying to prove myself, right? Because I thought that's what I need to do. I need to be everywhere, solving every problem. And because of the position that I was in, I was kind of like uniquely positioned to be working on like 7 different projects at once, like in a ton of meetings, like, and I was exhausted and I was frustrated. And the advice that he gave me, this manager, his name is Rob. He was like, listen, Vishak, like, nope, you're trying to be Superman right now. Superman is not real and nobody likes Superman. What you want to be is the old sheriff, right? Like, you don't deal with petty crime every day, but when there are big problems, then you're there and you're the person that people come to. And I think it's funny. I do think people like Superman, but he's not real. So maybe in real life they wouldn't, but it reframed how I thought about work and how I thought about even life, which is like, you don't need to always make people happy. You just need to be there for the big moments, for the big decisions, for the impactful projects at work. And if you can do that, then you'll take care of yourself and you'll make sure that the people who you love or that you work with are happy and they appreciate you.
Perfect. Also, looking back at your career, and you've already alluded to a couple of people, who are one or two folks that you like to give a shout out to who have been influential in your career?
Yeah, I talked about Scott Slinker, got me into tech, one phone call, one listen, kiddo, here's what you got to do. Love that.
Right.
Talked about Rob, engineering manager of one of the teams at Postscript, who has always been like someone that I could go to for really sage advice about life and has really helped my career and thinking about things like perception. And then one of my former managers, his name is Jason, and Jason probably taught me about prioritization in a way that I've never thought about before, which was like every week I would meet with him and I'd be like, Jason, here's 5 things that I'm worried about. And we would go through the list and be like, you're not doing these 3 things. Just message them right now and tell them it's not getting done, you know, which is an incredibly simple but effective framework to not be overwhelmed. And as long as you let people know, like, it's not going to get done. Here's why. I got to get these other 2 things done. And as long as you hopefully work at an organization where people can respect that, that's probably how you should be taking on being overwhelmed, right? So I've worked with a ton of incredible people. Super fortunate in my career. Takes a village, but those 3 people stand out.
Yeah, definitely does. Last one for you. Fill in the blank for me. Working at an early stage startup is
wild. Wild.
It is wild.
You want me to elaborate?
That's why. Yes, and it's on par with your sheriff comment because, you know, Wild West.
It's the wild, wild west. Too. This is, Postscript continues to go through a lot of change. Not all of it is easy.
Yeah.
But some of it is super rewarding. And I'll sometimes tell people I work with this. If the dust is settling, it means we're moving too slow. And it's a constant state of learning to deal with change and just keep your eyes forward, because otherwise you get distracted by the wildness of it all.
That's true. Ishaq, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story with us.
Hey, thank you, man. It's been a pleasure.